Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Our friend Joe Ziemba, the author, historian, and podcaster of When Football Was Football, the Chicago Cardinals expert, he joins us once again for Jersey Number 66, and it's all coming up with his expert stories in just one moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we are podcasting from America's North Shore, bringing you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So in taking the snap from the sportshistorynetwork.com and handing off to pigskindispatch.com, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of pigskindispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. And we have another bonus edition, our Football by Numbers series, Jersey Number 66 today. And we have our good friend Joe Ziemba to join us. Joe Ziemba, welcome back to the Pigpen for this Jersey 66.
Darren, this number 66 is quite intriguing. And some of the legends we're going to meet today include the meanest man in football, a guy who was selected as having the worst body in NFL history, another mean man who actually appeared in a movie with the Monkees, and we have a guy who exchanged game films with Elvis Presley, not Elvis Gerbeck, Elvis Presley. So we're looking forward to an exciting program with you today, Darren, and thanks again for having me on.
Wow, we appreciate you coming on, but your teases there have sent me to all directions here. So I'm intrigued to hear the stories. I'm sure our listeners are too. So I guess we'll start off sort of where we always do with our Pro Football Hall of Fame and their selections of who wore number 66. And I'm going to mention the first one because they're saying that Nick Buonocore wore the number 66. And in our off-air conversation, Joe, you and I, neither one of us could find where Nick Buonocore wore number 66. So we're probably going to dismiss him from our 66 conversation, if that's okay.
No, I agree. I could not find him anywhere either. So good call.
Okay. And so the other ones that the Pro Football Hall of Fame has listed are Larry Little, Gene Hickerson, Bulldog Turner, great name, Billy Shaw, Ray Nitschke, and Alan Faneca, who will be enshrined on August 8th, 2021, with as part of the 2021 class, is on there also. Yeah. So good selection of Hall of Famers to talk about.
I think I have a good one to start with. And Darren, have you ever heard a Chuck Norris joke?
I've heard of Chuck Norris, but I don't know if I joke about him. He might karate chop me or something.
He's a tough guy. I mean, some of the things that go around about Chuck Norris said that he's the only man alive who can dribble a bowling ball. And if you want to see a list of Chuck Norris's enemies, just check the extinct species list. Or Chuck Norris never used a spell check on his computer. If he happens to misspell a word, Oxford will change the meaning. But before there was Chuck Norris, we had Ray Nitschke, linebacker, Green Bay Packers. And way back when, this is 40 years ago, I think back to the 60s, some columnists were writing about Ray Nitschke as if he were Chuck Norris. For example, they're going to make a movie about Ray Nitschke's life, but Bela Lugosi was busy. So 40-some years ago, that was a horror star, Bela Lugosi. How come Ray Nitschke didn't get cold playing in 13 below weather in Green Bay? Well, because his straitjacket was fur-lined. And one more. Ray Nitschke plays middle maniac for the Green Bay Packers, and his contract calls for a guy to wipe the foam off his mouth between plays. So before Chuck Norris, we had Ray Nitschke of the Packers, a guy who grew up in the Chicago area, who was orphaned at a young age, raised by his older brothers, and all he did through high school and college, it seems, was get in fights. But he finally found a way to put that aggression in place on the football field. Intercepted 25 passes, played for Green Bay from 58 through 72, and wore number 66 all except his rookie year, on his way to making 7 All-Pro teams, won 2 Super Bowls. But I was surprised, Darren, that he only was named to 1 Pro Bowl, as far as I could find.
Yeah, that is surprising for, you know, the standout player that he was during his career. And, you know, his name is, you know, synonymous even to this day, you know, half a century later, with, you know, just great linebacking. You know, he's right up there with the Butkuses of the world in linebacker history.
He was, yeah. In fact, he was also named as, I think, the Sporting News as number 18 on the list of 100 greatest players in NFL history. And he was also voted as the NFL's top linebacker all time, 1969. But you mentioned Butkus, and Ray Nitschke named his dog Butkus in honor of his linebacking counterpart. But he's the guy who also appeared in the movie Head, which starred the Monkees. And he had this mean look about him, and he tackled Peter Tork, one of the guitarists, I guess, throughout the movie. I haven't seen it. And pretty typical for a guy who has a bridge in Green Bay named after him to this day.
You know, I do. Now that you say that, I do remember that Monkees movie and Peter Tork. Peter Tork was the one, I believe, that wore the winter hat all the time. Sort of the wavy hair, taller fella. And I do remember Nitschke tackling that. You say that. So I might have to go back and relive that movie again.
We have, you know, a bunch of mean guys, and this week wearing number 66. And you can't go very far without mentioning the name Conrad Dobler. And I'm swaying away from the Hall of Fame guys just for a second.
Okay.
But Conrad Dobler played for the Cardinals, both in St. Louis, then he went to New Orleans and Buffalo. But he has quite a record as being a mean guy. He did make 3 consecutive Pro Bowl appearances, 4 times All-Pro, and just a guy that seemed to be known for being kind of mean. In fact, he was called by Sports Illustrated. He was on the cover at one time as the pro football's dirtiest player, which was describing him in 1977. And it mentioned he had some dirty deeds, like he once made a player cry. He pioneered the chop block and the head slap, both of which are now outlawed. And he once bit the finger of Vikings Doug Sutherland, to which he explained, "He put his fingers through my face mask, and I don't think they were there to stroke my mustache. So I bite one finger in my life, and I don't even chew on it." Legend grew from there. So that was Conrad Dobler.
I think Mike Tyson might have borrowed that same line when he was fought Holyfield.
Absolutely.
Wow. That is interesting. All right.
So we have another kind of guy from the Hall of Fame, though, Bulldog Turner, who was known as a gentleman off the field. He was a rancher in Texas, but Bulldog Turner played for the Bears 13 years, all with number 66. He was 8 times All-Pro, and he was fast for a lineman. He was good size, 6'1", 237 back in the 40s. But in college, he ran a 100-yard dash in full football gear in 10.8 seconds. So when he was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1966, he was only the 3rd center. He was a member of the all-1940s teams. In 1942, he had 8 interceptions, including one of his best interceptions was in the 1943-40 title game. When the Bears beat Washington 73-0, he intercepted a pass and ran it all the way back for a touchdown. His coach, George Halas, called him the smartest player I had in 40 years. And later, Halas also talked about Bulldog being a little mischievous on the field. He said one time, I guess Bulldog had a couple of too many cocktails. And there's a story one night that he fell from a 3rd-floor window on a hotel. An awning broke his fall, however, and as Bulldog brushed himself off, a policeman ran up and said to him, hey, what are you doing, guy? What happened here? Bulldog says, I don't know. I just got here myself. So that's another one of our Mean Guys Hall of Famers.
Wow. Hey, you dig up some real classics, Joe. Those are great stories. Wow. They really tell about the character of these guys. But Bulldog, I mean, he's another one that has some real credits to his name. You know, like you said, those four Pro Bowls, seven times as an All-Pro, four NFL championships. You know, I think it's pretty safe to say that both he and Nitschke are on our list. I think we can come in agreement on that. And Dobler, maybe we gotta wait a little bit on here. We'll put him on a standby list. Might be a little early for him yet.
Yeah, it's going to be tough getting 10 spots. There's a lot of talent, and including a couple more mean guys. The next one I'd like to share is called the Big Nasty, Kevin Cogan, 6'7", 317-pound lineman for Dallas and Oakland, and he also played for San Francisco, Miami, and San Diego, made three Pro Bowls. But he wore number 66 for all 14 years of his career. He was also called the meanest man in football at the time, which he didn't understand. He was an all-around athlete in high school. In fact, he started out as a catcher on the baseball team at 6'7", but they had to move him to first base because the umpire could not see over him to call the pitches. But I think he may be one of the only folks that was ever ejected from a Pro Bowl All-Star game. And what happened was he was good at taunting people. And during the 1998 Pro Bowl, he kicked a defensive end Neil Smith in the wrong place, which capped a mini ride. I guess Smith was also ejected for throwing punches. But Grogan said there was really a method to his meanness on the field. He said, if you start working these guys a little bit and let them implode, their game is done. They're supposed to be rushing the quarterback and they end up forgetting all about that stuff. There's a lot of little games inside the game, and that's one of them. So he used his ability to aggravate opponents over 213 games with five teams over a long, long career. So number 66, Kevin Cogan, not sure even despite three Pro Bowls, he'll make our top 10 because it's going to be tough competition today.
So, yeah, very interesting in Kevin Cogan. Now, he has three Pro Bowls and two Super Bowl championships. I think he might be a candidate to go on early. What do you think?
I think he would be, yeah.
Okay, so he will be our third one that we'll put on our list here. And who would you like to speak about next?
Well, just one more mean guy. And then, Darren, I promise we'll be done with the mean guys for today. Bill Burgi, William Earl Burgi. Maybe it's pronounced Burgi. I am not sure. I apologize. He spent 12 years in the league with Cincinnati and Philadelphia, all wearing number 66. He was six times All-Pro and appeared in five Pro Bowls. And he was on the second team of the all-1970s decade team, and he's a member of the Eagles Hall of Fame. And he was also in college. He was voted the top player in the history of Arkansas State, coming from a smaller school. But part of his career, he was involved with a contract dispute with Cincinnati. In fact, the team sued him when he threatened to jump to a new league way back in 1974. At the time, he was making about $38,000 a year, and then he was offered $525,000 for 3 years. So the team sued him, trying to hold him to their contract. He never did jump to the new league, but they traded him to the Eagles that year. But he had a bit of a reputation as a mean player as well, and never was quite sure how it started. Some of the things that were called, described him over the years were the man's a mean one, an animal on defense. He batters opponents. He's a cheap shotter. He's a dirty player. And of course he said, I'm sure there are millions of guys with the same temperament as me and who dive into the work just as intensely as I do, he said at the time. So Bill, we think you might be close to making our top 10 today. Again, six times an All-Pro during his 12-year career, and quite a vicious linebacker as well, a middle linebacker.
I'll tell you what, I wonder, just those descriptions that you said that opponents and others were saying about him, some of those almost sounded like the lyrics to the Grinch song from about that same era of the late right. 1960s, early 70s. Oh, he's the mean one, Mr. Berge. So, wow, those are some mean players and some real characters in football and some great players in football. Now with Bill Berge, I think he's probably another one we could probably put on the list here early, don't you?
Yeah, I think so, especially with six Pro Bowls there.
Right, absolutely. And the All Pros as well. So, yeah, good picks there. So that takes us up to four gentlemen we've placed on our list so far in our greatest number 66s. And, okay, so we're through the mean guys. Now I'm interested to see what direction you want to go next.
Yeah, how about some of the Hall of Famers? I noticed there's a guy in the list that's from the Steelers. I'm not sure if anyone on this call is with a Steelers fan, but we've got Allen there, a 9-time Pro Bowler, won a Super Bowl in the Hall of Fame this year, as you mentioned. And so you may have some local color to add to that, Darren.
Well, Faneca was definitely – he was sort of that ideal Steeler guard, you know, very, very athletic. I think Bill Cowher is the one that drafted him in the late 90s. And as a matter of fact, he was. And that's the kind of offense that Cowher wanted. He wanted that power running game, the guards that could, pull and get out in front and, get blocks on the outside, get to that second level quickly. And Faneca, he checked all those boxes, and he was a great Steeler guard. And we were really sad when he left in free agency and went over to the New York Jets near the end of his career. It's a similar situation we have right now with David DeCastro, no longer on the Steelers. They're sort of that same mold. You know, Faneca, probably a much, much better player than DeCastro. It's just sad to see these good guards leave the Steelers, and Faneca was definitely one of them.
There was an interesting statistic about when he did leave the team, and he had made 7 Pro Bowls with the Steelers. And if you think of that 7 Pro Bowls, that was 5 Pro Bowls more than all the other Steeler guards had compiled over the previous 49 seasons. So it showed his impact on the team.
And you had some good guards in there too, in those Steelers teams, yeah. Well, at least in the 70s you did. I'm not sure about the prior to that, but, but probably weren't any from that mixed Steelers Cardinals team of the 40s, but we won't get into that.
Oh,
again.
Right. 1944. Yeah. The card pits. Oh boy.
Yeah. So somebody I know had a podcast, I think, that said that was the worst Cardinals team ever. So
somebody on this podcast to choose from.
Yes. Somebody on this podcast, probably one of the worst Steelers teams ever too. And there's a lot to pick from there too. Okay.
So interesting to see Faneca's induction this year. Hall of Fame, richly deserved.
Most definitely. We're Steeler Nation is very excited. There's 5 Steelers going in 1 year. I don't think that's ever, I'll probably never happen again. But there's 3 from the 2020 class with Bill Cowher, Troy Polamalu, and Donnie Shell. And then on the 2021 class is Alan Faneca and the player personnel director of the 70s, Bill Nunn, who drafted people like John Stallworth and I believe LC Greenwood, maybe Mean Joe Green. So from some of those traditionally black colleges. So very deserving for all those fellas. And the Steelers are playing in the Hall of Fame game this year. So it's quite a Steelers weekend in Canton. So, but Alan Faneca, I think he's probably another one who goes right to the top of the list here and goes on, I believe.
I think we have to put him on there. Another guy that probably really deserves our attention is Billy Shaw. We're going back to when he started in 1961. He only played 9 years, but wore number 66 every year for Buffalo. In fact, he's the only player in the Hall of Fame who never played in the National Football League. So he was on the all-time AFL team. And also, he's been on the named the Bulls' 50th anniversary team, Bills. First member of the Hall of Fame since 99, but a lot of folks might remember him for the Billy Shaw rule. And the Billy Shaw rule came about for those coming into the Hall of Fame to remember always, always remember who to thank for your induction. Billy gave a wonderful speech apparently in 59, but forgot to thank his wife. And when he got sat down, his daughter said, you forgot to mention your bride. And a couple stories were that Billy asked to get back up there on his hands and knees, and he apologized to his wife. And another story says that Eric Dickerson covered for him. And after Billy had asked him, "Can you say something? How could I do that?" So now all the inductees are reminded of the Billy Shaw rule when you do your induction speech at the Hall of Fame.
I think all of us husbands around the world have all been in that position at one time or another, not at the Hall of Fame speech, but something where you'd like to take some time back and make a mention of the significant other. That's for sure.
That's right. Billy was all pro 8 times. So we might consider him for our list as well.
Yeah, I think he's a definite shoo-in also. So that takes us to 6, you know, in the all pros. I mean, he's right up there with anybody on all pros. So very good player. And I didn't know that. So he is the only one in the Pro Football Hall of Fame that never played in the NFL.
Yeah.
Interesting. Apparently. Very interesting. Okay. Go ahead.
I did want to mention another guard who has been called the greatest downfield blocker in the history of pro football. He's the guy we mentioned earlier who exchanged game films with Elvis Presley. So an interesting story is Gene Hickerson played his entire career of 15 years with Cleveland, and he wore the number 66 every year. He was a 6-time Pro Bowler, made All-Pro team 7 times, and went into the Hall of Fame in 2007. So his 202 games played are still 4th in Browns history from what I've been able to find. And it just seems he was just such a strong presence in that line that Sam Huff, the linebacker, once said about him, "You know, Gene Hickerson, well, don't tell that SOB, but he was the best offensive lineman I ever played against." And Jim Brown, the great Jim Brown, was the one who called his blocking buddy the greatest downfield blocker in the history of pro football. Back to our wacky part of the story, that he was apparently from Memphis. He was friends with a fellow Memphis resident named Elvis Presley, and he called Elvis Eli and would send him films of the Browns game after the game so Elvis could watch them down at Graceland. So that's one we haven't seen before of an NFL player being good friends with Elvis Presley.
Yeah, when you're friends with the king, that gives you a little bit of respect here. I was wondering how that connection was going to come. I'm like, boy, what? I was trying to think of how was Elvis's connection to the Cleveland Browns, but the Memphis connection, that makes perfect sense. I think Hickerson's probably another one that's just you know, probably no argument from either of us that he should be on the list. So that takes us to 7 already, and we're not even through all the Hall of Famers yet.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Larry Little, who was an undrafted player in 1967. He signed with San Diego because they offer him the most to come try out of $750. Ended up playing 14 years, 12 of those with number 66. 5 Pro Bowl, 7 times an All-Pro, and won 2 Super Bowls. He has been named to the 1970s All-Decade Team. He's in the Dolphins Honor Roll and, of course, was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1993. Sporting News in 1999 named him as the 79th player on its 100 Greatest Players list. And apparently he was the only player at the time to be named the AFC's Outstanding Offensive Lineman 3 straight times by the Players Association. So he was not only respected on the field, but off the field. And there's a nice quote from the Miami Herald after he retired that said, "Larry Little's value to the Dolphins can't be measured strictly in terms of All-Pro honors or longevity. Instead, integrity, honesty, and hard work were his calling card." So that's Larry Little. Again, one that's hard to ignore for our top 10 list today.
Yeah, I don't think he can be denied either. So that'll take us up to 8 players. Now, I was always under the impression that Larry Little was a selection by Don Shula bring him in, but being in Miami already in 1969, Shula would have still been with the Colts in that Super Bowl III game.
Oh yeah, that's
so,
right.
So he was already in Miami before Shula got there then.
Yeah, he arrived in 69.
Hmm. I did not know that. So learn something here. All right. So we have eight gentlemen already locked up for our number 66. So, and we've got a lot of more great players that are not in the Hall of Fame yet talk about. And I'm not sure what direction we want to go to next, but I'll let you lead the way.
All right. Well, I've got four other linemen, I believe, who, in my opinion, really probably deserve Hall of Fame recognition. And I'm going to start with Joe Jacoby, the big 6'7", 305-pounder that played his entire career with Washington. Won three Super Bowls, four-time All-Pro, three times first-team All-Pro, and he was elected to the All-1980s team. But he was called the, still today, the greatest Washington player who's not in the Hall of Fame. He was, of course, a member of that famous Hogs dominant offensive line. And there's a great quote about him from the Los Angeles Times, talking about him playing back in the day. This is from 1992. It said, "You watch Jacoby on the line of scrimmage, and he reminds you of a wily old boxer. He has all the moves. He makes them, but he's never in a hurry. You just feel sorry for the guy across from him. Because you know in a minute, Joe is going to lift him in the air like King Kong with Fay Wray, hang him out to kick and squirm for a minute until the play goes by, then drop him with a thud and wander calmly back to the huddle." What a great description of an offensive lineman who usually don't get that type of recognition.
Wow, that's quite an imaginative description, that's for sure, by that columnist. I'd love to put Jacoby on, but you said you have four, so maybe I better pause here a second and hear who else you got to tell us about.
Let me give you a couple more. One is Harley Sewell, who goes back to starting in 1953. He played 11 years, 10 of those with Detroit, and he wore number 66 all those years. He was six times on the All-Pro teams. He was a smaller guy. He was only 230 pounds, even back 60, 70 years ago. That's still pretty small for the line, but he was had a great quickness that allowed him to clear out bigger defenders before they got set. And he also volunteered to play on special teams, and one year he was credited with 85% of the tackles on the kickoff unit. He was named to the College Football Hall of Fame in the year 2000 after he graduated from Texas. And they talked about his size quite a bit. He said one year he tried to bulk up to 235 from 230. And he said, "They were a negative about me weighing 235 in training camp. You had to lead plays around. If you couldn't run, you got run over. If they ran over me a couple times, well, I'd be back in Texas looking for roughnecking jobs." So Harley at 230 pounds, six times all pro, we got to consider whether he's going to make our top 10 today.
Yeah. Now, did I hear you right? Did you say that the one season he made 85% of the tackles on the kickoff team?
On the kickoff team, that's remarkable.
For a lineman, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, for anybody, that's amazing, but that's quite a bit. Wow, that is,
yeah.
Got a little bit of range there to do that. So, very impressive. But who else do you have?
Well, next we're going to look at Jack Stroud. Jack came in the league in 1953, played all 12 years with the Giants, wearing number 66. And again, here's the guy who made the All-Pros team six times, three Pro Bowls, one NFL championship, known for being a great pulling guard. And another great athlete. He was 6'1", 235 in the NFL, but in college at Tennessee, he actually won the javelin throw in the Southeastern Conference twice. He then spent 2 years in the service and is known as one of the strongest men in football. Talked about the way he would work out. And this is before we had Nautilus and a lot of great things like that. But when he first came into the league, Coach Steve Owen took one look at him and said, "What the hell am I going to do in the pros with a 215-pound tackle?" So he got him up to 230, and increased a little by little because he could do strange things like one-arm push-ups before Rocky Balboa. So those were his feats of strength as one of the strongest men in football, even if he only did weigh 215 pounds at one time in his career.
Another one, very impressive. I didn't know ever. I don't think I've ever heard of him before, but you really made a great case for him as well. And I guess you still have one more, if my count is right, right?
Yeah, we've got one more, and this is a center, Tom Nalen. Played his entire career of 14 years with Denver, wearing number 66. Five times All-Pro, won two Super Bowls. Again, as a center, he was known for his quickness. He was 6'3", 286, and he's a member of the Broncos Hall of Fame. So during his tenure as a center on the Denver Broncos, they had six different running backs who had 1,000-yard rushing seasons behind him. So some good statistics there. Super Bowl winner, five times Pro Bowler as well. So we have Mr. Nalen then to consider.
And I remember him. He was quite the beast also. Very, very well respected. Well, I'll tell you what, you really gave us a lot of gentlemen to think about for these last two spots. The only one I can even add and probably doesn't even shine a light to these other ones is maybe like David Deal, the guard tackle that most famously for the New York Giants, and you've stayed there his whole career from 2003 to 2013. He had one Pro Bowl and two Super Bowl rings on him, but I don't think he's got enough credentials to make this list with this illustrious cast that you've presented to us here.
Yeah, and then he was the NFL Man of the Year in 2012. And perhaps even more importantly, he went to a high school that I went to in Chicago called Brother Rice High School. He went a few decades after I did, and of course made the school proud, whereas I was asked to leave after 2 years. The brothers got tired of beating me, which they did every day, whether I liked it or not. But Dave Deal, of course, is a great player for a long time.
Well, you know, I take that back. I do have one more, and I mentioned him a little bit earlier. And that's David DeCastro. You know, David, we're not sure if his career is done yet. It's done in Pittsburgh, at least for this year. You know, he's another one of those guards that we said is sort of in that same mold as Fanica. Came in with the Steelers as their first round draft pick in 2012, played all the way through last year, and has sort of a mysterious reason he was cut. We're not sure if it's injury related. He's what he's saying. Steelers camp saying it's for other reasons. I don't know. It could be salary cap reasons. Not sure. I'm sure that'll all clear out here in the next few months. But he had six Pro Bowls so far in his career and two All-Pro seasons himself. And he might not be done yet. He might sign on with another team and be able to play in the coming years. So it's another one to probably think about.
Yeah. There's a guy that's not only has the most career interceptions for a linebacker, but he was the one we alluded to earlier, had the worst body in the history of the National Football League. And he was awarded that by none other than the best-selling author, George Plimpton. So we're talking about Don Shinnick, who played his entire career with the Baltimore Colts, 13 years, 12 with the number 66. He was a three-time NFL champion, but only once made All-Pro despite that. And he actually led the league in interceptions in 1959 with seven. But his number of 37 still leads all linebackers in history. After his playing career was done, he was a coach for several teams and later was named to the second team of the All-Decades team for the 1960s. But apparently George Plimpton was doing an article with Bill Curry, and they were talking about him and which guys that are in this car who had the worst legs, the worst stomach, and overall Shinnick won it for some reason. The worst overall body. And he had the worst hips. He had the worst chest, the worst neck, which outplayed things like the worst feet for Bubba Smith and the worst knees by Taz Anderson. So that's something I guess you really don't want to be known for. But he was named the worst body in the history of the National Football League.
I don't know if that's a great moniker that you'd want to adopt there.
Right. So,
Well, I've got to mention one other guy, and I'm on a Steelers roll here. We had another 66 that only had 1 year with the Steelers, but it was a significant year. And that was Tom Newberry. And he was a guard center. Majority of his career was with the Rams from 1986 all the way to 1994. But he came to the Steelers in 1995 and started 15 games for them. And that's that year, the first time that the Bill Cowher teams made the Super Bowl and they lost to the Dallas Cowboys, I believe it was the 95 season. And he ended up in his career having two Pro Bowls, two All-Pro seasons there. So I think the Steelers like to give that Jersey 66 to their best guard. And hopefully they can find another 66 in the near future to meet up to the credentials of the three gentlemen we talked about today that were 66 for black and gold. But I don't think Tom's going to make our list either, but just another one that's significant to talk about, mention here.
Mm-hmm. There's another player who played in the league for 12 years, was undrafted, won three Super Bowl rings, played 189 games, and yet never started one game in his career. And we're talking about Lonnie Paxton, the center for New England and for 3 years for Denver. And the reason he never started was he was a long snapper. So he probably won't make our list today, but I want to recognize a long snapper for once and some of his accomplishments.
You definitely have the trend all throughout these football by numbers that you've been on with. You are a friend of the long snapper and the punter and kicker. That is for sure.
We'd like to get some recognition with those guys. Yeah.
You definitely give them the love, and I'm glad you do.
You may remember the New York Jets winning in 1969 when Joe Namath predicted that, the big win. And one of the last guy from that team to retire of the starters was Randy Rasmussen in 1981. And he played 207 games in the league, which is still second most in the Jets history and most by a non-kicker, since we're talking about kickers as well. So he won that Super Bowl and was twice All-Pro. And winning the Super Bowl, of course, is great for anyone, but Randy said something like, because that was the beginning of his career, he said, "My thought after we won the Super Bowl was, wow, we'll do this every year. This is easy. And then I found out the realities of pro football. The people were calling and sending telegrams and everything else from all over the country. It was a great feeling. I was on top of the world." Of course, after that, he had to endure 11 consecutive non-winning seasons with the Jets.
Yeah, that's some tough sailing there, that's for sure. But another great player. I don't think he's quite has the mustard on his resume here to go and battle with these other fellows that we've talked about for those last two spots. Okay, do you have anybody else that you want to bring up for consideration, or are we ready to go?
Others that might be of we can think about. I don't know if they'll be considered, but one of them is Myron Patios, a graduate of Notre Dame who played for Pittsburgh, the Rams, and Washington. And he was part of a 15-player trade that went around in 1971 when George Allen left to go coach the Redskins. He made this trade to bring a lot of his good players with him. So he was another guy who refused to wear a face mask in the early days, had his nose broken several times. But he has been named after those first 4 or 5 years with Pittsburgh on the Steelers all-time legends team. So one that you may remember, again, Myron started though in 1961, and missed the 62 season. And on his way to three times, he was named to the Pro Bowl and played for 12 years, as we mentioned. Probably not enough to make our top 10 today as we kind of wrap up. But one guy that might is a guard named Bob Kowalkowski, played from 66 through 77, and he played for Detroit. So Arnie Chapman of the Sports History Network may like this one. He started every game for five straight seasons. His son also played the National Football League, but he was well-liked by his teammates. In fact, quarterback Greg Landry said of Bob, "Bob was a little undersized compared to most of the offensive linemen, but he made up with it with hard work and always going the extra measure in the weight room, the film room, and or during practice. So after football, he was a great contributor to social causes for the blind and for children's causes. And his wife was actually the Lions manager of accounting operations for a year. So the whole family got quite involved there. So Bob, congratulate him on a 12-year career, 11 years wearing number 66. He spent his last year with the Packers. So probably not enough to make our top 10 list today, but I wanted to bring him in. I don't think we had any other Lions today.
No, Arnie would be definitely proud of you for doing that. So I'm sure he's listening and smiling right now. Okay. Do you have anybody else, or are we ready for our deliberating?
Yeah, I think we're ready. Yeah, those were the only ones I thought might have a chance to make this very laudable top 10 list today.
Okay. Now I'm going to go through and ones I think that we want to take a look at again. You let me know if we missed anybody. Tom Nalen, Joe Jacoby, Conrad Dobler, Harley Sewell, Jack Stroud, David DeCastro, Bob Kolowoski, Don Shimmick.
And two that I might think of as maybe whittling the list would be Jacoby as one.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he definitely deserves to be on there. So we'll put him in. So that takes us to nine.
I'm thinking of Shinnick or Nalen.
And Nalen was sort of coming up on my list here. Mm-hmm. But not that I'm opposed to Shinnick either.
Yeah.
But I think Nalen's sort of a guy I feel should probably be on there.
Yeah, I think we both agree on that one.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, there's our 10. Let me go through real quick. In no particular order, we have Ray Nitschke, Bulldog Turner, Kevin Gogan. I want to say Grogan. had to refrain myself there. Bill Burgee, Alan Faneca, Larry Little, Gene Hickerson, Billy Shaw, Joe Jacoby, Tom Nalen, and I think that's it. I think I got everybody there.
Did we mention Bulldog Turner?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. We got Bulldog on there also.
All right. We got a good list.
Yeah, that's a great list. That was a challenging one because there were so many good players to put on there. So I'm happy that's jumping up a lot here in these number 60s. So good deal. Now, I don't know how you feel about it or if you noticed it yet, but I know you use the Pro Football Reference for these exercises a lot like I do. And recently, just this past week, we're recording this on July 16th, but back on Monday, July 12th, the Pro Football Reference ended up getting some information from John Turney and Nick Webster. John is the one that runs the Pro Football Journal website, and they collected from game films and game books and whatever else they could get their hands on, the sack totals for players from 1961 to 1981 that were absent. If you remember, the NFL made that an official stat in 1982. So the Pro Football Reference now has sacks all the way back to 1961, I believe. Might be the 1960 season, but I think it's 61. So that's kind of a great thing for us football researchers looking at the pro sack numbers for some of these defenders.
Well, it's an incredible tool, and I just really congratulate those gentlemen for putting that together. I can't imagine how long that took to wade through every single game and every single play. And I just looked at the list briefly, but there's some surprises on there about some of the leaders in some of the categories, and just really great to see. Again, we're gonna see that other players are recognized for what they did, for a statistic that no one thought existed. So I'm so happy to see that. And it just goes that that some of us who research, not that we've ever done anything that incredible, it really is appreciated.
Yeah, I believe to answer your one question, how long it took, I spoke with John a couple months back, and I believe he told me it was like 30 years of work that he had done. And I'm not sure how long Nick had done it, but I can imagine. I thought that was even quite a feat to do it in 30 years, because that's a lot of statistics and a lot of game film and game books to look at.
And you just have to hope that the game statistics are available for something like that. And it's difficult when you go back, and sometimes it's even difficult verifying scores when we go way, way back. But for individual records, they're not always available.
That's for sure. And a lot of those are handwritten, so that makes it even worse. They're not all typeset like you would think more of the modern game books are. Some of them were, you know, somebody just scribbling down a number. And, I know penmanship is not always the best, myself.
Oh, yes. I got all excited once when I was researching a team, and after not having a whole lot of luck going through newspapers, I went back and someone had discovered a notebook with handwritten notes about the results for this particular team, which was great, great news, until I went back and I found out that the coaches who were responsible for writing in the scores maybe did them every couple of years by memory, so they weren't always accurate.
But that brings up a question I've been meaning to ask you. You just spawned a memory in me by your that story.
Uh-oh.
Now, you wrote your book on the, what was the military academy that you lived by?
Morgan Park Military Academy.
Morgan Park, and yeah. Your father coached there, if I remember correctly.
Correct, yep.
Now, you got to go through their archives that they had that somebody was going to toss aside, or they were going to go to the rubbish pile, and somebody ended up saving them and archiving them so that people like yourself could look through them. Now, how were those in? Were they all handwritten and unorganized that you had to filter through, or what kind of condition was something like that?
Yeah, surprisingly, even though they went back almost 100 years, a lot of the information was typewritten. So they had yearbooks, which are very helpful, of course, in constructing a team. Those are usually fairly accurate. We found a couple. So then I would try and verify it by finding a newspaper account. But except for some handwritten correspondence, a lot of the information was typewritten. Maybe it was a rule at the time for the school, but I was quite surprised, because even though I've seen literature from a pro football team in the 40s, a lot of it's handwritten, that the letters that were sent out to players and other correspondence wasn't typewritten. So yeah, the problem, as we just discussed, or you mentioned, of being able to decipher what the guy is actually saying, even though it's all the English language, it sometimes doesn't read the same. But yeah, it was nice to be able to get to those archives and find so many typewritten pages, which made it so much easier.
Now, I'll put in the show notes for listeners, the links to get to Joe's book on the Morgan Park Academy football history. And so you can add that to your collection and be enjoyable. And what's the full title of that, Joe?
That is called,
I put you on the spot. I know. I'm sorry.
That's Cannons and Legends, the football history of Morgan Park Military Academy.
I just wanted to test that memory, and gosh, I couldn't get you to break. You still came through.
Lucky I kind of cheated with a copyright next to me here. So that was.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're probably right in your library there. So
Amazon had a deal this week, so I had to buy one. I always wanted to read it.
Well, Joe, I thank you once again for your time. Well, before we let you go, what do we have coming up in the near future here on When Football is Football podcast?
Well, next podcast, which will be released in a week or so, is a lot of fun. It will be a trip back to the training camps way back when for both the Chicago Bears and the Chicago Cardinals. So we have some fun stories in order to tell the whole, I guess, the travelogue of what these teams did. When the players themselves speak to us about what they ate, how they traveled, what their conditions were, and we learn about an angry Bears lineman shooting a pistol through a ceiling to quiet down a rookie who was sleeping above him, George Halas looking for spies in the cornfields of Rensselaer, Indiana. So it's fun stuff. So that'll be on the Sports History Network in about a week or so from when we're talking now. So that'll be the third week of July 19th.
Okay. Well, that's coming right up around the corner. We might have this. I think this podcast might come out a day after that we're recording right now. So it should be out and ready to go on Joe's When Football Was Football, sportshistorynetwork.com, and look for that latest episode. Or, you know, make sure you follow him on, as well as all of our podcast hosts on the Sports History Network, on your favorite podcast provider, or go to sportshistorynetwork.com, and all those episodes are right there for your listening pleasure. Joe, I want to thank you once again for your time, for your great knowledge, and your excellent stories on these players that make our favorite game so interesting and beyond just the football field. And these Jersey 66s, couldn't have done it without you, my friend. Thank you very much.
Thank you again for the opportunity. And I appreciate the fact that we're able to share some of these truly wacky stories about the earlier days of the National Football League.
And I think you are signed up for Jersey number 70. So I think we'll be talking to you again real soon.
All right. We can't wait. We'll be ready. Thank you again for that as well.
Tickets here. Me too.
Day, sliding into brand new kicks. Got cash, looking slick with my row one tips. Everywhere, always up front like a boss. Auburn, flossing up on Tiger Walk. Tuscaloosa, crimson, roll tide. Girl blowing up at Ole Miss to five. But down in College Station at Kyle Field, 12th man, pumped a keg, boy, and that's real. Game day, alumni, throwing up cash. Showing up fast, Buckeye Nation about to smash. Game day, Eugene, Tucson, Athens, Cali, Trojans, Coliseum smashing. Nebraska, big red going all out. Michigan, six figures in the big house. Texas, under burnt orange skies, watching from the rails as the champions rise.
Always be up,
always up front. Sizzle is a media blitz. Tailgate parties and some devious-ish. Bikinis, kegs, barbecue chickens. Oklahoma, Owen Field of boom pickings. Turn it up, flame a bustin' on the hot. Georgia in the house, Sanford the Bobby Dodd. No matter where we roam, we callin' it home. Notre Dame, Palo Alto, or the Carrier Dome. It's the people we see. The fans, the celebrities, the roar, the crowd in the swamp at Tallahassee, Gainesville, Knoxville, Lincoln, or Seattle. With row one tees, you're always ready for battle. Pasadena pageantry, smelling like roses. Glendale turned for fiestas. You know this, gnarl and sweet as sugar, tossing up beads. Miami hot and juicy, squeeze the oranges, please.
Always be
always up
there in the front.
That's right. Row One Brand has teamed up with Sports History Network, and we are offering a 15% discount. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/ROW1 and use the coupon code SHN15 to get your 15% discount on the thousands of unique items of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, more, and any gallery item up to the sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. That's Row One at sportshistorynetwork.com/row1, coupon code SHN15.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in.
we invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.